He kōna i purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Nga te mare, good morning New Zealand. This is Morning Report. Ko Corindan Tena in Wellington this morning. It's Rāmiri, Friday, April the 19th.
Oh, someone is sounding happy it is Friday. Ko Ingrid Hipkiss. So I'm in Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. Kia ora, yes, it is Ingrid here. And as you just heard, it is Friday, our last show of the week. Big story today, looking at the Fens review into their handling of the Auckland storms and the cyclone Gabrielle. I think when we get these stories in hindsight after, you know, a long time has past, it's about the failings, finding those failings, but also really wanting to find out what has changed since those since that happened, and if we are in fact any better prepared than we were, you know, a year or so ago.
It's preventing a failure, isn't it, and a catastrophic one that we also talked about this morning with the Auckland apartment block that is failing to meet its fire safety standards, and we spoke to the Body Corp representative there, the lawyer, also the Auckland Council, and there's still some big questions there about the processes around that. The political panel was in this morning, always a favourite. Joe Moyer in with Katie Scotcher. We chewed over a lot of ground there, including issues around the cuts in the public service, as well as Christopher Luxon's, what are we calling it? Not TikTok, it's a tuk-tuk tour.
Well, a TikTok tour, because he has been posting a lot on TikTok as well. He's slightly more adept at that than we are. Hey, enjoy the listen, and thanks for listening through the week. Well, Fire and Emergency has released a review into their response during the Auckland floods and Cyclone Gabrielle. It found Fens lacked specialist response equipment, training and preparedness to effectively handle the disaster. During the Auckland floods, firefighters without boats were going into neck-deep water to rescue people from their homes. While during Cyclone Gabrielle, crews were forced to borrow a rowing club's dinghy to help rescue multiple people where the water levels were too high. Joining us for more on this now is Fire and Emergency National Commander Russell Wood. Kia ora, good morning.
Kia ora, Ingrid. Good to speak with you.
So a fairly comprehensive report there detailing what a lack of planning, training and equipment. Is it fair to say Fens was woefully unprepared for weather emergencies like these?
I think, Ingrid, what I would say at the start is our thoughts are still with the communities and the people in those communities that were so severely impacted, and our thoughts remain with them as they recover. But also, I think the report talks about the absolute great job our people did when they responded with skill, ingenuity, determination and empathy. And like our people do, they go above and beyond, and many, as you've said, they had to improvise at times. You know, we commissioned this review because we wanted to learn from it. It had found some areas that we do need to work on and improve on, and around things like planning, training and equipment, specifically as it relates to severe weather-related events. And I don't think anyone needs reminding, these were somewhat out-of-scale events, so quite challenging for us.
Your staff, though, were let down in turn, weren't they? Because they didn't have the support, the equipment that they needed. So their job, a difficult job, was made more difficult by a lack of planning.
You know, I think we're trying to build our capability, and, you know, the report also talks about, makes a distinction in our legislation between our main functions and our additional functions. So, as you would expect, our main functions centre around firefighting and structures and wildfires, hazardous substance response, motor vehicle crashes and urban search and rescue. And then actually severe weather event responses in our additional functions. And what the Act says is that we can build capability and capacity in those additional function areas, but it shouldn't be at the expense of our ability to deliver against our main function. So we take that on board, and we were starting to build, for example, in our specialist water rescue teams. But, you know, the weather conspired against us, and we were only in very embryonic stages, but that's been developed further since these events.
I take your point, because I see in that in the report it says this is not a main fire and emergency function. So how do you manage that, given that there are obviously resources needed for the staff, the training, the equipment to deal with the weather emergencies, which are going to happen more and more often, when it's not considered a quote, main function?
Well, I think this is our new reality, and perhaps the country's new reality, Ingrid, that these types of events will become more frequent and much more severe. So how do we, the question is, how do we balance then our efforts, our capability development, so that we can ensure that we're there when the public call us? I mean, I want to be really clear, the public won't distinguish between main and additional functions, and we get that. We just want to be there and available for them when they call in their time of need. And what I would say is that we have we are a national organisation, so we have a lot of people and resource spread across the country, and that's one of the benefits of being a national organisation, that we can take trained and skilled people in fire trucks and utes and vans, and we can deploy them across the different main functions and additional functions.
But looking at some of the specific failures that were pointed out, not having a pre-prepared trigger function for when everyone kicks into action for a weather event, that was missing. Has that been remedied?
Well, I think a good example of what we've undertaken in that area is last week's impending weather in the South Island. And I know our region and district leadership teams were gathering very early on when that became apparent. And we're starting to pre-position people and assets in areas that were forecast to be impacted. So yeah, I think we have come on since last year.
What about the issues with the 111 system and communication issues there?
I'm not sure what you're referring to in the 111 system. That we, you know, we don't run the 111 system. If you're talking about our communication centre staff, again, they were put under extreme pressure. You know, quite frankly, the demand outstripped supply, and they felt that very keenly. And as we know, in places like Tairawhiti and even in the Hawke's Bay, we lost telecommunications more generally.
So has an alternative or a robust system been put in place of that?
Well, during and since, we've deployed, you know, technology like Starlink, for example, to try and lift the resilience. The other thing that I think will be very valuable going forward is the delivery of what's called the public safety network, and that'll be a new digital and mobile radio network and a more resilient and better coverage cellular network for emergency responders.
Okay. What about the boats? You had to borrow dinghies to get to people in flooded areas.
Well, I think we're always going to be having to work with partners who have expertise in this area, and some fantastic work was undertaken at the time with Surf Life Saving, for example.
So has that relationship been solidified? Because it was also, you know, the equipment was hired from service stations as well. So when you talk about partners, that's fairly ad hoc. Is there something more substantive in place?
Well, it's a balancing act between what sort of core capability we wish to build. And since the events from last year, we now have 6 specialist water rescue teams strategically located, and we deploy them either in advance or in response to an event. But we'll continue that discussion with people like police and Surf Life Saving, for example, about how we can join up our respective capabilities so it doesn't all fall on one agency.
Okay, so you don't have the teams, do they have boats, or you're still having to borrow those?
No, they have boats.
They have boats, okay. And the other equipment, the search and rescue fleet, was also short and in some places unreliable. What's happening with that?
Well, since the events, we've started to allocate particularly, you know, protective clothing, et cetera, more suitable to these types of events to our urban search and rescue teams, including, you know, personal safety locators and mobility devices. So, yeah, we've started that process.
Vehicles as well?
We didn't want to wait until the report came out, so we started to move on things from our early observations of our own.
Sure. They have vehicles as well, new vehicles, or the number needed?
So we're now reviewing what our ancillary fleet needs to look like. So I'm not talking about fire trucks. I'm talking about sort of utes and SUVs, et cetera. So that work is also underway. And again, it's
so
a balance.
So work underway, but those vehicles haven't been procured yet?
Not the new ones. They're not that far away for urban search and rescue.
Just finally, if there were to be another event like this today or tomorrow, would you be better prepared? What assurances can you give to the public and to your staff?
Well, the assurance I can give to the public is that the Foreign Emergency will be there when they need us. I think we are better prepared. We have learned already from those events last year, but we'll continue to work to develop the required capability and the capacity that we need, and that will take a bit of time, but I think we are in a better place than when we were in 2023.
Hundreds of residents of a central Auckland apartment building will find out today whether they have to evacuate their homes. Auckland Council issued a dangerous building notice for the City Gardens apartments on Albert Street, saying its fire safety system is not up to scratch. The Body Corporate's lawyer, Tim Rainey, says he's confident residents will be able to stay. Joining us for more is Auckland Council General Manager Ian McCormick. Good morning, Ian.
Morning.
What assurances have you had that the work has been done? Do you think that they will be able to stay?
Look, we've been in contact with them throughout the week, so we know that they've made good progress. I've got a team on site this morning. They'll be meeting with Body Corporate reps and contractors. They'll be going through the outstanding items and identifying any outstanding items on that list and the implications for the safe occupancy of the building past midday on Monday.
How is it that they're sort of able to scramble this in a week to get back so they don't have to leave, yet they've taken what seems like years to get to not deal with things?
Motivation, I guess, is probably a big thing. You know, from our perspective, the issue's heightened. You know, our response is heightened as a result of two incidents that occurred. There was an alarm activation where it was found that one of the door handles and one of the fire doors had fallen off. It was fixed within 24 hours, but it just shows, I guess, a maintenance issue. And second of all, a sprinkler activation where someone broke one of the sprinkler heads, flooded an apartment, but the automatic alarm to FAN's headquarters didn't work because someone had managed to turn the system off in the locked call point. So, you know, these are significant issues.
Sure, but it doesn't sound like this is new. This sounds like, I mean, haven't had a warrant of fitness since 2017, so presumably you've had negotiations or dealt with this building and its owners for quite some time. Why have they not had this warrant of fitness?
Ongoing system maintenance issues. I mean, they've got a number of systems in that building that are probably, end of life. I think some of their plumbing system, for example, they seem to have had ongoing issues where, lines would break. This isn't part of the fire safety system. This is, you know, plumbing and end up compromising, again, some of their passive fire systems, you know, some of their the ceiling through some of their pipe work, et cetera. And there's a whole range of ongoing issues. I mean, it would be fair to say I'm not aware of another building like this, thankfully, in recent years.
The thing is, I mean, FENZ's letter, you know, is saying it's unclear whether the building's fire alarms could reliably alert occupants to a fire or that residents could reliably find the fire escape routes due to the condition of signage. I mean, these are really serious issues, and I'm just struggling to get my head around how it is that they haven't had a warrant of fitness building since 2017, that these issues were not being dealt with. Is it that the council wasn't tough enough on them, or that they simply weren't acting in good faith or something?
Yeah, I mean, good question. I mean, there's just been ongoing issues for a long period of time, and they're not necessarily the same issues. There's just been a range of different things that get addressed, and then the new ones crop up. So it just leads itself to, I guess, major issues in terms of the way that the building's been maintained, and, yeah, we've had enough of it.
All right. Are you getting similar problems with other buildings? Are there other buildings like this? I mean, because it's a big building, this is why we're talking about it, a lot of people. Do you have other apartment buildings that don't have warrant of fitnesses and are not meeting their standards?
So, I mean, the management of safety systems of buildings is a complex matter, but we don't have any other apartment buildings where we've had to issue dangerous building notices, and this is a...
That's not the same thing necessarily, though, is it? I mean, you've got to the point after a very long time to issue this notice. Have you got other buildings that don't have the warrant of fitness they should and who have problems with their fire emergency procedures?
Not to the point that we've got concerns for the safety of occupants. So there will be from time to time issues where buildings have safety systems like escalators or lifts that that aren't working at a particular point in time that results in additional actions that need to be taken. So, yeah, we don't have any other buildings like this in Auckland.
Time now for our weekly political panel, and we're joined by RNZ's political editor Joe Moyer and political reporter Katie Scotcher. Welcome to you both.
Good morning.
Kia ora.
All right, there has been a lot of stories, and they keep coming, about public service cuts. Joe, I'm interested in how the government is handling this. You get the sense that they've lost the narrative a little bit on this, but they are pushing back to try and convince people that, you know, put this into proportion, sort of the cuts up after a big growth in the public service. How do you think they are fearing?
Yeah, there's certainly that feel of a pushback going on. I mean, it's hard not for them to push back when you've got these headlines coming through, bang, 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 you know, dark day, 1,000 here. We're up to, what, over 3,000 total now public servants that have lost their jobs. So not an easy one for the government to navigate. Also, it's going to be the budget day before we get a sense of a lot of this, which, of course, is not until May the 30th. So it's a long time for them to be fighting fires on this as well. The reason we have to wait until budget day is because that is when it will become clear how much of this money that's been saved in back office support stuff is actually going to go into frontline services. So we've kept hearing from Nicola Willis and others that the frontline, they're going to get that money. We're going to see more in, you know, police, health, education. But until May 30th, we won't actually know what that looks like. So in the meantime, you've got ministers saying, look, this is all for a greater purpose, but not a lot of detail behind it. There's obviously a lot of people who will say, this is awful, this is outrageous, particularly in Wellington and Auckland, where a lot of these public servants are. Flip side, you're going to have people saying, this is happening everywhere in all sorts of industries, and this is just the way that the world is at the moment, and you're going to have to move on. Katie, you did a story this week. You tried to get some questions out of Nicola Willis around redundancies and what that might look like. What were the sort of unanswered questions there?
So went to Nicola Willis to ask about how, or she'd received any advice on the projected cost of redundancies. We worked out that each individual or the average redundancy in the public service is around $50,000. So if you add it up to the 3,000 jobs that have been, you know, axed already,
that's
working out to be quite a big number. So I went to her and asked if she received any projected costs. She said that she hadn't. It was up to individual agencies. So I thought it was quite astonishing that she hadn't really asked for that figure, considering that will put huge pressure on those public agencies that are going to have to pay out that bill. Another unanswered question, and this was reported by Tova O'Brien and Stuff, was that Treasury hasn't provided advice on the flow-on effects of these public service cuts on the Wellington economy. So things like businesses here, hospitality, the property market, welfare and transport. Tova asked Nicola Willis why she hadn't, and she said the advice that she received is that government spending has risen dramatically, inflation is too high, etc., etc. So quite astonishing that there are kind of two major parts of this kind of puzzle here with really unanswered questions as to the flow-on effects and the total cost.
I'm interested in that. Let me be the devil's advocate here, because why should the government necessarily be thinking about, you know, the public service's role in propping up an economy like Wellington when it's got a big picture to look at? Is that the role of a government?
Well, I mean, interestingly, I think some of this work has, well, not work, some of the flow-on of it has already happened, because if you look at Wellington at the moment and you look at the number of people that work from home now, the post-COVID kind of impact, I think hospitality and a lot of those sorts of things that get impacted by the public service sort of ebbs and flows, a lot of that's already actually happened. And I think there have actually been economists who have talked about this, and the fact that you can't, there's not necessarily a direct sort of cause and effect that comes with, if you cut out the public service, well, then everything else is going to fall apart. There's, you know, there's plenty of other factors going into that as well.
The other thing, just very quickly on the cuts, I'm interested in, this has started to come out too, as to whether the cuts are in the right places. And we won't know until the budget. And one of the points someone, I think, made in a column this morning might have been Matthew Hooton, you know, that a lot of departments are simply cutting jobs that hadn't been filled, hundreds of them in some cases. But they may not necessarily be the right jobs to cut, but they're an easy, low-hanging fruit, if you like, because it doesn't, there's nobody assigned to that role.
Yeah, I think this is maybe the consequence of the government handing responsibility for, you know, these cuts to the government agencies. The chief executives of those agencies have essentially sole responsibility of choosing where the money that they have to save comes from within the agency. They're the ones who decide where the cuts are made. The government's kind of handed this over to them, passed the responsibility over to kind of free themselves up, I guess, of responsibility on that one.
Now, what have we got? Christopher Luxon, of course, going global. How do we think he's gone? I mean, quite a big trip for him. I mean, it sort of suits his personality, this one, doesn't it?
Oh, totally. I mean, this has been a real business trade type trip, which, of course, is, you know, Christopher Luxon in his happy environment. I think on the whole, he's done pretty well. There has been a little bit of diplomacy, political stuff. Of course, there is when you're having these bilateral meetings. But for the most part, it's been about around that sort of regional security stuff. He did have the, I guess, the complication of while he was in the air on the way over, they stopped in Cairns on the way over and, of course, found out what had happened with Iran over the weekend. That could have potentially derailed things a bit. But basically, those regional security lines, I think Christopher Luxon's kind of holding in a bit of a safe pattern on that, which is not surprising for the Prime Minister. I think you saw the same on trips with the likes of Chris Hipkins, Jacinda Ardern and John Key. Often it's the foreign ministers who kind of push things out a little bit with the nuance and the narrative, and you get the Prime Minister holding those lines. Christopher Luxon's done that with the diplomacy stuff, and he's done things a little bit differently too. He's with the business side of things. He's taken some of the business delegation into those bilateral meetings with world leaders. That's quite a different approach. That's very much Christopher Luxon wanting business leaders to hear firsthand what the issues are, how they might be able to work together and actually contribute to that too. So seeing that sort of corporate style, I guess, meeting the Prime Minister style on this trip with Christopher Luxon as well.
I also think that he has potentially come across as quite relaxed in the diplomacy space. I mean, this is his first kind of major foreign mission. He's, you know, faced questions all week about this kind of very tense global situation that we find ourselves in, and he seems quite at ease answering questions about it. I remember the first day he was asked whether or not he would be open to opening New Zealand airspace for Singapore to trial drones in, and he, you know, was willing to answer that question, whereas, you know, previously it could have kind of batted it away, but he seemed pretty willing to answer the question.
Yeah,
well, there's a lot of tricky questions when you think of the South China Sea and the diplomacy and the tightrope that is being walked by New Zealand, but so far you haven't seen any major gaffes. And a lot of world, you know, a lot of previous prime ministers have got into some very tricky territory on that stuff.
Oh, yeah, it's an easy one to stuff up, that's for sure. And he hasn't so far. But I mean, I come back to the point of I think he has very sort of specific advice and specific lines from MFAT, and he's not straying too far from them. Now, that's a safe thing to do when you're on your first sort of big stage international mission, and when there are very live issues flying around in terms of, you know, the Indo-Pacific, the regional security, China, everything that's going on there. I mean, the last thing you want is to have sort of a diplomatic night.
The one area where they may have got a bit of a blindsided was AUKUS, because Labor has come out quite strongly and sort of suggested that through Winston Peters' visit to the US recently, that the government has sort of gone off and lurched further towards AUKUS than where they had previously been. Now, they deny that, don't they? They say, no, it's the same position as Labor's, but Labor does seem to be changing as well.
Yeah, look, I mean, you have had both US officials and Winston Peters talking out about the fact that this is not what other people are making it. This is not what the Helen Clarks, the Chris Hipkins, the David Parkers are saying that it is. They keep coming back to the fact that this remains an information gathering exercise, and that, you know, we're away from AUKUS partners or New Zealand agreeing to anything. So, you know, very different perspectives here, because if you listen to what Helen Clark and Bob Carr this morning are saying, you know, it's almost as if they're suggesting that the deal's been done and we're just waiting for the piece of paper to be signed. But real pushback from the government. Christopher Luxon as well, real pushback from him overseas about AUKUS.
There was the language in that statement, though, to be fair to Labor a little bit here, the language was a little bit stronger around the practicalities of potentially working with AUKUS.
The powerful reasons.
Yeah, the powerful reasons. So the language was a little different, wasn't
it? So you did have Helen Clark and others already pushing back on this before that statement came out, but I think that statement has definitely not helped the situation, because you did have that quote-unquote powerful reasons to join. Winston Peters, of course, he came on the program and he pushed back on that.
He did.
And he said that, no, this is still in the same realm that it was when Labor was in government. And, you know, stop kind of trying to make this out to be some bigger thing than it actually is. Katie, you were at that panel yesterday where we had Helen Clark and Rob. What were the more interesting things out of that?
Well, I was just going to make the point that I think it's important to to make the difference between the two governments. I mean, under Labor, there were discussions, they were exploring this, and that was really clear. But we have seen, I guess, more enthusiasm towards AUKUS under the current government. I mean,
leaning in, I think.
Yeah, I mean, 2 months after the government was formed, we had Winston Peters and Judith Collins in Melbourne with Richard Marles, the Australian Defence Minister, kind of giving authorisation for his officials to come to New Zealand to brief New Zealand officials. So there is, I guess, more energy towards this.
That is time to cross the Tasman and chat with our Canberra correspondent, Kerri-Anne Walsh. Good morning, Kerri-Anne.
Good morning.
Obviously over there still reeling from the knife attack, firstly the one in the Bondi Westfield, and then also the alleged terrorist stabbing of a priest in Wakefield in Sydney's West.
Yes.
That's been dominating your news. The federal government wanting now to take action on social media because of the spread of misinformation about that.
Yes, it's really been the most extraordinary week here in Australia, and we're all, it doesn't matter where we live, we're all reeling. We find it quite incomprehensible that wherever you look, there seems to be inflamed tensions, and there seems to be this sort of febrile environment where you've got this sort of feeling that anything could happen. One hopes not, of course, but to have two real extremes of Sydney society, our most popular and populated city, suffering, you know, really violent attacks was quite extraordinary. But back to the social media, that has been a real problem. That has inflamed tensions, is that the misinformation spread, particularly around the Western Sydney episode, has meant that the federal government is been in contact with Meta, been in contact with all social media giants saying, you've got to rein this stuff in or we'll take action. The big question is, what action can they take? What, these are offshore companies, they're huge in their own right. They've shown in the past they're dismissive of small fry countries, which they consider us to be. There's very few batons we can wield, if you like, to pull them into line. And so it's a real problem for the government, and they've got their heads together trying to work out what they can do.
Mm. Your Prime Minister's also raised a few eyebrows by offering residency to one of the men who helped stave off the Bondi offender. What's gone on there?
Yes, the so-called Bollard man, French tradie, Damien Giroux, who stood at the top of an escalator holding a bollard, just stopping this bloke from coming up the escalator to where a whole lot of kids were playing. So he said, this is the sort of fellow we want in our country. And he said, you can stay for as long as you like. A very dangerous thing to do. Because at the same time, there were others here who were out here on temporary visas who also ran into the fray. For instance, a Pakistani man, Mohammed Taha, who said, from his hospital bed, just a moment, I was there, I tried to stop this man, I'm injured, I'm in a hospital. What about me? And the Prime Minister, a bit shamefaced, had to say, oh yes, well of course, let's look at your situation too. But it was a bad look. There was, you know, nearly 48 hours between both events, and it was only that the Australian newspaper contacted the guard in hospital that they got this story. And it also is a precedent-setting thing to say to somebody who has been heroic that he's on a temporary visa when so many are languishing in detention centres. Oh, by the way, you're the sort of bloke that we want in this country. You can stay. You know, there's a lot of controversy.
Yeah, he may have got caught up in that social media frenzy as well, because as you say, the Bollard man was a trending hashtag there. And the Bondi Centre reopens today.
It does. After yesterday was a day of reflection and mourning, where it reopened but not for business. It reopens today for business. There's a lot of apprehension there amongst staff who were present at the weekend's melee, and they're saying, oh, okay, we'll go back, but we're not really feeling that comfortable about it.
I can imagine.
So there's a long way to go.
Well, that's today's podcast.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Tune in tomorrow, wherever you get your podcasts from.
The Common Pheasant. RNZ National.